We live on a small island. We have a growing population. We have a cheap food culture, and we throw away a third of everything we grow. So the complexities around pollination is critical to our industry, our food industry.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy. And I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you. Your passion becomes theirs. And I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Jill Perkins, the Chief Executive Officer of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, Britain's only charity dedicated to the unique needs of bumblebees. Prior to joining the Trust, Jill worked for the Federation of Small Businesses. Using her experience in starting her own business in the world of agricultural services to help others flourish. It was a sabbatical working on community conservation projects in Borneo that led her back to the world of conservation. Jill, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today. Can you just tell me a bit more about your journey to where you are today?
Yes, indeed. And thank you very much for inviting me on. I love doing this sort of thing. And you talk about passion, and bumblebees are a great passion of mine. But I didn't know that originally. You know, when you're thinking about doing what subjects you're going to do at O and A level, or, you know, in my day, O and A level, and you don't really know at that age. But I did know that I wanted to be outside in nature. And even at that age, I chose subjects that may lead me there, like geography and biology. But I think as I grew older and went to college, conservation ecology came absolutely central to my values. The more I learned about it, the more that I got engaged with it. And, you know, doing all the volunteering work with conservation volunteers and things like that, it really, you know, it really felt that it was the right path for me. But life takes its twists and turns. And I married a farmer and we started a business. Which grew and grew and really honed and defined my values, because farming and conservation are not always great bedfellows.
No.
So I learnt a lot from that. But my move into a career supporting small businesses was still far from my passion. But it was taking that degree in business studies during that time I was with the Federation of Small Businesses. And I didn't know it at the time, was really going to underpin how I got to where I am today as Chief Executive of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. A lot of people think charities are not businesses, but believe me, they are businesses.
Yeah. Well, they are, yeah. And, yeah, we work with lots of charities and, you know, making sure that the money's coming in and looking at the profit and loss and making sure that you can pay people and do the work is a huge part of the job, in the same way as it with
yes,
any business.
It is.
Now, I remember someone saying to me, because as you know, I'm a professional lobbyist, and I remember someone saying, a government should never take on people who are in children's books as professions. So that's kind of firemen, police, and farmers. And as you know, at the moment, the government did take on farmers with the inheritance tax changes, and you're seeing the huge uproar there with farmers. I wonder if it also, you can also say the same thing with animals as well, because bumblebees are one of those animals. There are very few insects that people truly love, but bumblebees people do love. And I wonder if it's because they're just, they're there in children's book, aren't they? Even though they sting, people really love them. Why is that?
Yeah, but male bumblebees don't sting. There we go.
Oh, really?
That's your piece of trivia for today. So so you have the queen bumblebee and you have worker bumblebees, which are also female, but you also have male bumblebees. And the sting is part of the ovipositor, which is the egg-laying mechanism of the female. And, of course, males don't lay eggs, so they don't have a sting. So if you learn how to identify male bumblebees, you can quite happily manage them. They're lovely.
All right.
But you're right. In the trust, they are iconic, and they're a great vehicle for teaching all sorts of things, not just about ecology, but we use them in education to do with food. You know, they underpin our whole soft fruit industry. You know, I don't know whether I've another piece of trivia for you. Nobody knows where our food comes from, and we're very pro farmers because they do grow the food, but they can't grow the food without our pollinators.
No.
And, you know, the bumblebees have been in decline for quite some decades now, ever since the Second World War. And we now import 95,000 boxes of commercially farmed bumblebees into this country to underpin the soft fruit industry because we simply don't have enough.
Wow.
And I think that's...
And why are we having to import them? Why have they been decimated since the Second World War?
The main reason our bumblebees have declined is because we've lost 97% of our wildflower meadows. After the Second World War, everything went down for food, as it should have done. And so a lot of hay fields and meadows were ploughed up to plant food. And that was the beginning of the decline. And we've lost two to extinction since then. We've got two on the edge and six at risk. And then you go through the agricultural intensification and, you know, income neonicotinoids in the 1990s. That's a little bit like bayoneting the wound. You know, the decline was already well established, but intensive pesticide use and insecticide use was just another layer on top. And so they've been in decline. But I think, John, it's a really complex picture. You've got, we live on a small island with a finite amount of land. We have a growing population. We have a cheap food culture. And we throw away a third of everything we grow.
Right.
So the complexities around pollination and how we manage our insects in this country is critical to our soft fruit, to our industry, our food industry.
Right. So making sure that we're not letting that food go off in the bottom of the fridge, we're all slightly to blame for it. We all think sometimes, I'm definitely going to eat that, and then there it is at the bottom of the thing, and then you go to the snack drawer instead because it's just crying out for you, and that bell pepper and whatever is getting more and more wrinkly in the bottom thing, and then you feel very guilty and you throw it away. So just being a bit more thoughtful, maybe going to the supermarket less often and buying less items so it doesn't go off, because as we know, fresh fruit and vegetables does go off quickly. Are there other things we can do? Because the other thing as well is a lot of those crops are being grown for animals, aren't they? So is it about eating less dairy and meat as well?
Again, that's a really a complex subject to get into. But yes, if I try very hard to have at least two plant-based meals a week and try and cut down on the meat. But I like vegetarian food, so it's no big deal for me. Unlike my husband, who likes his meat and two veg, so it's a bit of compromise going on there.
Yeah,
I think if everybody, let's say, just bought one organic produce in their shop every week, what a difference that would make. Only one, and I know organic is more expensive, but just buy organic apples or buy organic carrots. Just imagine 68 million people all buying one piece of organic food. That make a huge difference to the way in which we farm and the way in which we look after our bumblebees.
Great. And we know that organic food, it's not just that it's better for you because it's got more nutrients in it, but it's grown on land where you have those wildflowers and you've got those things that are helping those pollinators. It's not all bad news, though, is it, with your stories? I know that there's been some positive stories. Can you tell us about those?
Oh, yes. So we've got two of our bumblebees that are on the edge of extinction. The great yellow bumblebee, big, fluffy, golf ball-type bumblebee up in the north, and the shrill carder bee, in our rarest English bee. Both of those have... beginning to recover due to our work, which is really important. But we had a really smashing good news story. We had a 12-year project called the reintroduction of the short-haired bumblebee. And that really captured people's imagination. And it involved us collecting queen bumblebees from Sweden, where they had where they're flourishing, where the short-haired bumblebee is flourishing, bring them over to the UK. We had to put them in quarantine for a while, and then we released them on the RSPB reserve in Dungeness, which is where they were last recorded. And I'm not quite sure why it captured the national and local press really got behind this story and really wanted it to succeed. And The Guardian picked it up, The Independent, all the local radio stations picked it up. It was all over social media. It was a really good news story for everybody to hear that this extinct bumblebee was going to be tried to reintroduce back into this country. So I think that was a really positive piece of news that we had.
That's great. And so when you have that positive news, and I think people are crying out for the positive news stories, aren't they, when they're, you know, in the climate crisis that we are in. And so it's easy to just, you know, be pulled into images of wildfires in California and some of those other really negative things. So people want to see the good news stories as well. And just a recent one, the sighting of humpback whales off the coast of Sussex recently. It was just such a great... It's so extraordinary story, and so you do get these positive nature stories that are as a result of human intervention. You know, that is, there are potentially a number of reasons. One of them might be negative in terms of climate change, but undoubtedly it is down to the ban on whaling in 1986, which has now come through. I know that there are 4 countries that are ignoring that ban, but largely humpback whales are now no longer hunted, and that's just such a great story. So it's good to point out the positive ones. In terms of types of media, where do you find is really useful for you in getting those messages out about the short-haired bumblebee and other things?
Well, I think I'm going to sound very unpopular now, or maybe even very, very old-fashioned. But I still think local papers have a role to play. You know, when we look at membership demographic of the Trust, it is the more mature end of society. I don't know the stats, but where I live, the local paper is well read and contributed to. And I think when you start to campaign about something, where you start to get people engaged and caring, isn't it in their local communities? Isn't it at a very local level where conservation efforts helps to ensure that, you know, we're doing the right thing for the community, and that's what gets them on board? I don't think papers are the only way. Absolutely not. You know, we use social media extensively. But you know what? And I think a combination is really good. I still think flyers about things, they seem outdated, but you know, they continue to be good methods of communications. I think we have to really understand the different audiences that we want to approach. Now, we're just going to start a Gen Z campaign because we recognise that the younger people now are really showing how much they care about the planet. I think there's a real groundswell of young people really understanding that we need to do something. And to get them interested, you know, we're going to have to go TikTok or some of the sites where the young people are to get them engaged.
And are you, so talking about social media, what are you favouring at the moment, as well as TikTok, which is a good example? How about Blue Sky? Is that one that you're looking at?
Yeah, we're just working up to going on TikTok because we don't have the capacity. We recognise that you need to be there all the time, and we don't have that capacity. We've just done a social media review, actually, and we're looking at, we want to understand what we're aiming to achieve via the proposed social media platforms. But we also have to have it aligned with our ethics as well, and understanding that is really important to us. So I personally, not the Trust, I personally have moved off X completely. Yeah. And I have my own Blue Sky account and I'm monitoring that carefully. And at the Trust, we're, through this review, we're looking at all our social media platforms and how they're operating, where we get the greatest connection and feedback from them.
Right.
And then we'll make our decision about where we move on social media.
Great. Well, I would say on TikTok, don't let perfection be the enemy of progress and going forward. And we embraced TikTok very early. And what I found really worked is sharing hard news. So instead of going down the route of when everyone was doing silly dance videos and miming things, we thought, well, we don't really want to do that. We don't need to do that. But we just put on short news clips. I've got something that goes out on a weekly basis called Plastic Free Post every Friday. You can sign up on our website. But I just said to one of the team members, I said, look, why don't we just read out these five stories? And it's got to be done in a minute. And you just have the headlines in the background. And we get huge amounts of views, far more views than we'd ever get on, say, YouTube with the same following. What you find is you don't necessarily build up the followers at the same level, so people aren't following you, but it will make it onto their feed, so they don't need to follow you, and we get thousands of views just on someone reading out those things. So I'd have a think about
that. That's really helpful. That's a completely different way of using TikTok, isn't it?
Yeah. And what you find is that because lots of Gen Z are getting their news on TikTok, that's where they're going for things. You know, lots of, I'd say the majority of people that work at Higgins & Strachey are in their 20s, and lots of them don't go on a holiday without going onto TikTok and seeing the top five places to go and all those kind of things. And we just copy the format. So if you do, you can just get someone in your team to, you know, if you have a newsletter or something like that, read out the headlines of this happened, this happened, this happened, and just post it. Because on social media, it's about trying and seeing what works. You know, that's the good thing about it. You don't need to make it perfect. You just need to have a go. You could try reading some out yourself or someone else in the team.
That's such good advice. I'm going to, as my old boss used to say, case. Have you ever heard of case?
No.
Copy and steal everything.
Right. Very good. Well, that's what this podcast is all about. I'm hoping people are listening and learning things along the way, as well as finding it entertaining. Yeah. How about public speaking? Is that something you're good at? Because that's another form of communications we haven't quite talked about.
I love doing that. I'm probably one of the strange people. So long as it's about a subject that I know and I'm passionate about, then standing up in front of people and getting them inspired and really motivated, engaged. Because the thing with public speaking, okay, you want to get some information across. That's absolutely what we're there for. But really, at the end of the day, I want people to take action.
Yeah.
I want people to get up from that meeting and say, I'm going to plant some lavender this year, or I'm going to buy some organic produce, or I'm going to learn about bumblebees and learn to identify them and start putting that data in our bee walk data. I want people to actually do something. And isn't that central to campaigning, John?
Yeah.
Whether it's signing a letter to your MP, or you just want that action taken.
Mm.
And I think when you've got people, real people in front of you, you can get that over more easily than more easily than I can for other forms.
And just in order to get action, you need to get people passionate. And to get passionate, you really need to know what the problem is. So let's just go back to where we were on what does a UK without bees look like? And you were talking about we're importing bumblebees into the UK, which I'm sure lots of people will be surprised about. I think they know that we import honeybees, but not bumblebees. And, you know, are there any countries around the world where they don't have the bee populations they need for their fruit and vegetable crops to pollinate them? And if so, what are they doing there?
So there's two sides to this story. I'll answer the latter part first. Yes, there are places, it's a bit of an apocryphal story, but over in China, where they have thousands and thousands of acres of cherries, pears, plums, all the orchards you can think of, where they've sprayed to get rid of the bugs that they were eating their fruit or damaging their fruit, and they're left now with hand pollinating some of the areas where they've lost all their pollinators.
So, sorry, what does that look like? Hand pollinating? There's a human.
Yeah, up a tree with a paintbrush.
And they're touching one flower, and they're getting the pollen off one flower, and they're moving it to the other. So they're acting as if they're a bee because they've killed all their bees.
Yeah. And, you know, bees in this country give us a free service. And we worked, the Bumblebee Conservation Trust is a science-based, evidence-led charity. So we worked with some scientists at Reading University, Professor Simon Pott's team. And they worked out, roughly, how much it would cost this country if we lost all our pollinators. So it would cost 691, this was back in 2013, so it cost £691 million to our gross domestic product. But that doesn't account for how much it's then going to cost us to do the pollination that our bees now can't do.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're looking at, if you look at our food and drink industry, it's a £1.8 billion food and drink industry in this country. And our pollinators, you know, of the 70 crops we grow in this country that need pollination.
So it's not just an environmental story, then it's a food security issue. Totally. Absolute food security. And you're talking about, you know, we don't have... The amount of money that you need to pay people in this country is different from China. We just would not be able to affordably be paying someone to be standing up on a fruit tree painting flowers to try and get them pollinated per cherry, per apple, would we?
And there are, of course, you know, in this country, we talk about bees generically. But if we split it up into our wild bees, which are bumblebees and solitary bees.
Great. Of which there are how many species, did you say?
So 24 bumblebee species.
Wow.
And about 200, nobody really knows, 220 odd solitary bee species.
Wow.
And then you've got honeybees, which are domesticated, not at risk of extinction, not in decline, don't need our help. They're, you know, so often, John, you'll see save the bees. And you'll see hexagons, honeybees, hives, and honey pots. And it's a little bit like me saying, I'm going to save the birds. I'm going to keep chickens. Because they're livestock. They're great. You know, I don't want to ditch honeybees because I like them too. They're bees. But they really do not need our help.
No.
They're absolutely quite capable of getting on and being looked after by beekeepers.
Yeah.
But some, you know, I don't want to... get too scientific about that. There's some plants that can only be pollinated by some insects, and tomatoes is just one plant. So only bumblebees can pollinate tomatoes. Honeybees can't do it. Solitary bees can't do it.
Oh.
And it's the way that plants and bees have co-evolved over the millions of years. And the tomato flower is quite different in that, A, it doesn't contain any nectar, which is the bait that the flower uses to get the bee to come in. And secondly, it holds its pollen really tightly in the anther. So it's not on the outside of a flower like we normally see. It's tightly held. And bumblebees, what bumblebees can do, they can disconnect their wings from their chest, their thorax, and they can vibrate their muscles at exactly 400 hertz. They bite hold of the anther. That vibration opens the anther, releases the pollen.
Wow.
No other insect can do that.
Wow, it's like they've got the secret code. It's like they're holding the code or the key to get in.
That's why our tomato industry is completely reliant on imports of bumblebees.
So that means every single tomato that we eat, if any of our listeners have eaten a tomato tree, is pollinated by a bumblebee.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Well,
let's look. I just spoke about a couple of the other places that you worked in your career. What's been one of your biggest kind of communications wins, where you feel like you really, really achieved things? I mean, you spoke about one there with the short-haired bumblebee and really getting people on board. Are there any others that you can point to?
Well, with the trust, I'm only going to talk about the wins we had in the Trust, but we had a project in Derbyshire called Pollinating the Peak. And this might not sound important to some of your listeners, but we won Project of the Year from the National Lottery Heritage Fund. So the National, is why you buy your lottery ticket. National Lottery Fund receives the money and they give it out too. It's a massive thing. And Pollinating the Peak won National Lottery Heritage Project of the Year. And we had Michaela Strachan.
I do remember her. Yeah. I mean, she's still on TV. Yeah.
Yes, she is. I think she's on Dancing on Ice now.
Oh, is she? Right, great.
There we go. She came and did lots of presentation, lots of media work with us to really exploit this win. And it was fantastic. You know, that, again, was such a major, important landmark for us, for the little Bumblebee Conservation Trust, although we're not so little now, to get this amazing award when you think of all the other National Heritage Lottery Fund projects that there are in the UK. Yeah, I mean, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And what's been one of your biggest challenges?
I think in the Trust, well, there's two really. One, everybody thinks honeybees and bumblebees are the same. That's a huge challenge. We did some audience insights work about 5 years ago, and astonishingly, 54% of adults didn't know the difference between honeybees and bumblebees. So there's a huge challenge, and we are working up a campaign now. We've got a little bit of seed funding where we can work up a campaign. And this isn't to dish honeybees at all. It is to explain the importance of bumblebees over and above honeybees. Bumblebees might not make honey, but for goodness sake, they make a third of everything that's on our plate of food. So
yeah,
I think that's an important message. So that's a huge challenge for us, getting people to understand the difference. And obviously, like every other charity, it is about money. You know, it's a continual wheel of getting the money in to achieve the outcomes that we want for bumblebees.
Great. You've told us all about the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. Are there any, you know that Higginson Strategy works with lots of different organisations. Are there any that you've seen that you really like their campaigns?
Oh, well, that's easy, because I love Hubbub. Have you heard
of
Hubbub?
Yes.
I think Hubbub are brilliant. They do so many creative ones. I love the bin one, where you could put in each bin, and the community fridge one, and they've got a gardening one going on now. But I think what it is about Hubbub, they're just so creative.
Yes.
Where they think about things through. I think they're terrific. They are a really brilliant organisation.
Great. That's a great one. Jill Perkins, CEO of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. You've been talking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. Thank you.